King Nimrod had ordered the building of a royal pavilion outside the main gates of the city. It was decorated with flags, flowers, and palm fronds. On the day that we marched for Sidon, His Majesty took up his station high on the saluting podium. He was surrounded by his Sumerian nobles, his senior military officers, and the city dignitaries. Lord Remrem, Colonel Hui, and the other Egyptian officers, who were to remain in Babylon with him, also occupied privileged positions on the dais. The previous day, I had sent all the servants, slaves, and other non-combatants ahead of our main force. With them had gone the baggage wagons and the remount herds of horses and camels. So I had with me only the officers and the fighting men when we marched past King Nimrod. All our chariots, weapons, and armour had been repaired, renewed, and polished, so they glittered in the sunlight. The horses and camels had been fed, rested, and groomed until they were in peak condition. Zaras had seen to it that the men had received the same attention, and had not been allowed to slack off. We looked like the hard little fighting army that we truly were. Many of the men had formed relationships within the local population, so there were numerous weeping ladies lining the road that led down to the coast. Some of these were already growing big with child. All this added abundantly to the excitement and drama of the moment. Toran rode at my left hand, and my two princesses at my right. Loxias had somehow managed to find herself a place close behind the Minoan ambassador. This no longer surprised or perturbed me. I had learned that she no longer slept in the same chamber as my own girls, and that since Toran's arrival in Baghdad, she had found new lodgings for herself. I made no further inquiries into the matter. With the ambassador, my royal princesses riding on each side of me, and the regimental band of horns, flutes, and drums coming up behind us, I led my men out of the city gates. I halted the column when we came level with the royal pavilion. I dismounted and climbed the steps to where King Nimrod stood on the podium. The band stopped playing, and the crowds fell respectfully silent as I went down on one knee before King Nimrod. His Majesty lifted me back onto my feet and embraced me as fondly as my own brother might have done, if I had one. This was only fitting, for I had restored his kingdom and his army to him. I had also made him a rich man, and replaced a great part of the fortune that his father, King Marduk, had squandered. We exchanged vows of eternal friendship, which, on my side, were not entirely sincere. Then we parted. As I remounted my own stallion, I raised my right hand in preparation to give the order to march, and the band played the opening bars of the regimental anthem. In this fraught moment, a well-beloved voice at my left hand uttered a cry that reverberated off the massive walls of the city. "Stop!" cried Princess Bekatha, and we all obeyed her command. The music of the band, together with the cheers of the crowds, faltered into an awkward silence. Every eye, including mine, turned and focused upon her. "What ails you, my darling?" I asked in placatory tones. I saw that she was on the verge of one of her famous tantrums. Perhaps I am partially responsible for the abandon of Bekatha's temper. I may have been overly lenient with her in the past. "What does we think he is doing up there on the platform, hiding behind Lord Remrem, while I am being marched off on my own to some bleak and godless island at the far end of the earth?" Bekatha flung out her right hand and pointed out the person who had given her such dire offence. "Just look at him, skulking there." Every head in the gathering, including that of King Nimrod, turned towards Hui. "You said you never wanted to see Hui again," Loxias reminded Bekatha. Bekatha rounded on her. "You keep out of this, or you'll be very sorry for yourself. Loxias is right. You said you hated Hui." Tehuti came gallantly to the support of the Cretan girl.
"I never said that. I never used the word hated."
"Yes, you did." The other two girls spoke in unison, and Tehuti elaborated a little further.
"You even said you were going to have him beheaded." I never said beheaded. Beckatha's eyes filled with tears of fury. I said punished. I said I would have him punished. Those at the back of the crowded podium began to demand information from those in front, who could understand a little Egyptian. What did she say? She says she's going to have somebody beheaded. Little children in the crowd began whining petulantly to be lifted onto their parents' shoulders so that they could have a better view of the execution. Even I heard you say that we is an oaf and a barbarian. I entered the conversation circumspectly under the cover of the hubbub. All I said was that we shouldn't have laughed at me. You don't think he is ugly? She dropped her eyes and her voice. Not really. In fact, he is really quite sweet, in a funny sort of way.
What about his five wives?
He promised to send them home to their mothers. I blinked.
Obviously matters had already advanced far beyond my control. Perhaps it would be better if we left him here in Babylon, or if you stick to your promise and have him beheaded, I suggested.
Don't be so horrible, Tata.
Are you absolutely certain that you want we to come with us to Crete?
She nodded, and her smile was irresistible, to me at least.
I stood in the stirrups and shouted over the heads of the crowd, "We! Get your kit packed and fall in! I'm not going to wait for you. If you've not rejoined your regiment before sunset, I will post you absent without leave."
I kicked my heels into the flanks of my horse, and we marched for the coast. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Colonel Hui scramble down off the royal podium with indecent haste. Ignoring Lord Remrem's protests, he rushed towards the city gates to retrieve his kit. I wondered why I felt so pleased with myself. I had just made a difficult position almost totally untenable. There was no profit in it for me, except that I now had the best charioteer in Egypt back under my command. And I had my little Beckatha happy again. We followed the Euphrates River in a northwesterly direction for the following 6 days, until we intercepted the king's highway at the city of Resaphah. Then we turned to follow the highway down through the mountains as far as Ash-Sham, the city of Jasmine. Since leaving the Red Sea, we had travelled in an enormous circle which had never brought us closer than 700 leagues to the Hyksos-dominated lands around the northern reaches of Mother Nile. From the city of Jasmine, we could at least head directly west for the port of Sidon, on the most easterly shores of the Middle Sea. This was the most beautiful and pleasing stage of our long journey. It took us down through the mountains and forests of Lebanon. The highway was lined with gigantic cedar trees that had never felt the axe. They seemed to be the pillars on which the sky was suspended, reaching up to the veritable home of the gods. At this season of the year, their upper branches were decked with hoary garlands of crisp new snow, and the air was redolent with the scent of their resin. As we dropped down towards the coast, the weather warmed, and we could divest ourselves of the furs and heavy woolen shawls that we had purchased in the city of Jasmine. We emerged from the cedar forests to discover another mountain standing before us. My guides assured me that this was the Rana Mountain, which in the Canaanite language means perfect in beauty. It stands upon the shores of the Middle Sea, between the Phoenician ports of Tyre and Sidon, and separates them by a distance of almost 20 leagues. The trade road that we were following was split by the mountain. We took the right-hand fork, and as we rounded the flank of Mount Rana, we were afforded our first glimpse of the sea. It was a marvellous shade of deep cerulean blue that stretched away to the horizon. Even the bellies of the towering mountains of cloud above it were stained blue by the reflection of the waters below. The port of Sidon was one of the most prosperous and bustling trade cities on this coast. The harbour was crammed with shipping. Even at this distance, I could make out the double-headed axe emblem of Crete on the sails of many of the larger vessels. These were part of the flotilla which had conveyed Toran from Crete to this place. He came to bid me farewell, and then rode ahead to the port to go aboard his flagship and take command of her. He would sail ahead of us to alert the Supreme Minos to our imminent arrival. I selected an area of open ground bordering the road half a league outside the stone walls of the port. Here a stream running down from the slopes of Mount Rana would provide us with an adequate water supply. I ordered Zaras to set up our regimental camp on this site. Before the camp was ready for occupation, a delegation emerged from the main gates of the city and came down the road towards us. I saw the man leading them was dressed in the robes of a high-ranking Sumerian officer. He rode up to where I stood and dismounted.
"I am Naram Singh, the governor of the province of Sidon."
He held his clenched fist against his heart in a gesture of respect.
"Of course, I know you are Lord Taita. Your name is already known and revered throughout all of Sumeria. I am strictly commanded by His Majesty King Nimrod to accord unto you all respect and to obey your instructions at once and without question. I am to see to it that you and the royal ladies in your care lack for nothing."
"Thank you for this friendly welcome. My first request to you is that you supply us with fodder for our animals." Naram Singh spun on his heel and rapped out a string of orders for his subordinates. They scurried away to do his bidding, and the governor turned back to me.
"Is there any other way in which I can assist you, my lord?
Please lead me to the shipyards where my flotilla is being refitted. I am eager to inspect the work." The six galleys that I had purchased from Nimrod were at first sight a major disappointment to me. They were standing on stocks, so that I was able to examine their hulls beneath the waterline. I made the mistake of comparing them to the great Minoan triremes that I had captured at the fort of Tamiat. These Sumerian ships were almost half the size, and I could see from the design of the hulls that they would be much slower and not nearly so handy. With an effort, I thrust aside my disillusionment and determined to concentrate all my attention on making the best of what was at hand. Over the next few weeks, I spent most of my waking hours in the yards with Zaras and the shipwrights. They were making the best of a bad job, but that was not enough to satisfy me. I always demand perfection. I inspected every plank and spar. I prized out nails from the hulls at random and inspected them for corrosion. I did the same with the bronze fittings. I dug with the point of my sword into the caulking of the hull to ascertain the quality of the workmanship. I had all the sails unfurled and laid out on the beach so I could go over them minutely, searching for and repairing tears and weak spots in the canvas. Then I ordered a series of modifications to the hulls. Zaras and I had discussed these in detail during the long journey down from Babylon. When I showed the superintendent of the shipyard my drawings, he grumbled and groused and came up with a dozen objections, which I beat down relentlessly. I wanted to employ these galleys in close support to our land forces that would soon be operating against the Hyksos legions along the northern shores of Egypt. Despite my original misgivings, I was now confident that these ships would be capable of moving large contingents of men swiftly from any point in the delta to where they were needed most. However, troops were ineffectual without their chariots and horses. The yard superintendent finally capitulated to my demands and built loading ramps into the sterns of my galleys. I made him reinforce the decking between the rowing benches so that this could carry 12 chariots with their horses even in heavy seas. We would be able to reverse these vessels up to any shelving beach or other suitable landing site and deliver a squadron of over 70 fighting chariots with their horse teams in the traces and their men in the cockpit ready to go into action immediately. Once they had achieved their objective, they could be recovered from the beach just as expeditiously. While this work was being carried out, Toran received orders from the Supreme Minos to delay his departure so that he could sail in convoy with us. He was to place his large and commodious galleys at my disposal to convey the royal princesses and their entourage in greater comfort than they would enjoy on my much smaller vessels. It was fortunate that the Cretan ruler had accorded me this courtesy.
Otherwise, Torren would not have had the opportunity to witness the warlike capabilities of my small force. By the time that the modifications to the hulls of my ships were completed, the season of storms came to an end. The gods blessed us with fair weather and moderate seas. But before we set sail for Crete, I determined that we must put to the test the seaworthiness of the renovated hulls and the operation of the modifications which I had installed. At the same time, I would be able to drill my charioteers in the operation of the stern loading ramps. We put to sea and sailed up and down the coast for several days, landing our chariots on every feasible beach or headland, and then recovering them again. I kept the men at it until they and their horses were thoroughly trained and skilled at these manoeuvres. When at last I was satisfied, we sailed back to the port of Sidon. In the early morning, 2 days before our final departure for Crete, I was walking down from our campsite to the shipyard to supervise the day's work, when on the outskirts of the port I was accosted by a one-eyed beggar. I tried to brush him aside and continue my conversation with Zaras and Hui, who were accompanying me. The filthy rascal was so importunate. Whining, he clutched at my sleeve. I turned back and raised my staff to beat him off, but he showed no fear and grinned at me impudently. "Lord Arton challenges you to a game of bow," he mouthed at me. I lowered my staff and gaped at him. The statement was so incongruous, coming from that toothless and odorous maw, that for once I was taken completely aback. Before I could recover my wits, the fellow thrust a minute roll of papyrus into my hand and then darted away down a crowded alley. Zaras immediately charged after him, but I called him back. "Let him go, Zaras. He is a friend of a friend." Zaras stopped reluctantly and looked back at me. "Are you sure that he didn't cut your purse? Don't you want me to beat the truth out of him just in case?" "Have done," I told him. "Let him go. Come back here, Zaras." He obeyed me, but looking back over his shoulder longingly. I returned immediately to the camp and sequestered myself in my tent before I unfolded the papyrus. I saw at a glance that it was indeed a message from Arton. His calligraphy is unmistakable. Like his manner, it is pretentious. "On the fifth day of Pakon, the vulture dispatched a pack of 200 jackals east from Zanat to intercept the wounded falcon at the hole in the wall and prevent his flight to the new island nest." The contents of the message itself confirmed unequivocally the identity of the author. In the private code that Arton and I employed, the vulture was King Gorab. 200 jackals meant that number of Hyksos chariots. Zanat was our code name for the border town of Nello, between northern Egypt and Sinai. The hole in the wall was Sidon. The new island nest was Crete. Of course, the wounded falcon was my personal hieroglyph. In plain language, Arton was warning me that 16 days previously, Gorab had dispatched a detachment of 200 chariots along the coastal road from Nello to Sidon to intercept me and prevent me setting sail for Crete. It was not a great shock or surprise to me that Gorab and his minions had learned of my mission. In any company as large and diffuse as the one I had led from Thebes to Babylon, and now down to the port of Sidon, there would be somebody with a loud mouth and others with big ears. We had been long enough on the road for the news to have reached Gorab's lair in Memphis, and for him to react to it. Even though I had taken every precaution possible to cover my tracks, I was resigned to the fact that Gorab knew that I was in command of this mission. My reputation precedes me. He must know also just how formidable an opponent I am. I did not waste a moment longer pondering how Arton had garnered this information, if it were authentic, and how he had delivered it to me. Arton has ways and means of doing things just as I have. He did not make mistakes, again, just like me. I stuck my head out of the flap of my tent and shouted for Zaras. He was waiting close at hand, and he arrived almost immediately, with Hui on his heels. Get the men and chariots loaded back onto the ships at once. I want to sail before noon, I told them.
Where to? Hui asked. Is this another exercise?
Don't ask idiotic questions, Zaras rounded on him savagely. Just do what Taita orders you, and do it quickly.
It was a full hour short of noon when I led my flotilla out of Sidon Harbour. At my invitation, Toran stood beside me in the stern of my flagship, which I had named the Outrage. Outrage had been my initial reaction when I first laid eyes on her. As soon as we cleared the breakwater, I turned on to a southerly heading. The rest of my ships tacked in succession behind me, and we ran parallel to the coast in line astern. I had made some rapid calculations based on the succinct information that Aton had given me. If, as Aton had warned me, the Hyksos raiders had indeed set out from Zanat on the 5th of Shemu, they would have faced a journey of over 400 leagues to reach Sidon. Laden chariots could cover only about 20 leagues a day over such an extended distance without crippling the horses. Horses have to rest and graze. Thus the journey would take them almost 20 days in all. According to Aton's intelligence, they had already been on the road for 16 days. Therefore, they were probably only 80 leagues or so ahead. I anchored our ships as soon as the sun set. When Toran demanded why I was reluctant to sail on through the hours of darkness, I explained to him, I can't take the chance of sailing clean past the enemy in darkness. But anchoring will not delay our meeting for too long. The Hyksos chariots will be closing with us at their best speed. We can expect to meet them at about noon on the day after tomorrow. When I gave Toran these calculations, he had another acute question for me. How will we know when we do come level with them? Surely we will only have occasional glimpses of the coastal road from the deck of this ship. Dust and smoke, I told him. I don't understand. 200 chariots will kick up a cloud of dust that we will be able to see from a great distance out at sea. Toran nodded, but then insisted, What about the smoke? It is one of the Hyksos' many appealing habits to burn every village they capture, preferably with the inhabitants barricaded in the buildings. You can be sure their progress will be marked by clouds of dust and pillars of smoke. They truly are an unlovable people. As I had predicted, an hour past noon on the second day, I spotted smoke rising from beyond a copse of trees, not more than a few hundred paces inland of the curling line of low surf that was breaking on the shore. I climbed to the masthead, from which vantage point I saw that the fires had been very recently lit. I could tell this was so because the column of smoke grew denser and rose higher as I watched it. Then more smoke sprang up from three other separate locations beyond the first column. There goes another village, and every living creature in it, I muttered. And at that moment, I saw two female figures emerge from the bush and scrub above the beach. Both of them were running with terrified abandon. One of the women was carrying a little child over her shoulder, and she was looking back as she ran. They raced down through the yellow beach sand to the water's edge, and then turned to run along the damp verge where the sand was firmer under their feet. They were looking out at our ships and waving frantically to us. Suddenly a chariot of Hyksos design came dashing down a rutted track through the scrub above the beach. There were three men in it. All of them were clad in distinctive Hyksos armour and bowl-shaped bronze helmets. The driver reined in his horse before they reached the treacherously soft sands at the edge of the sea. All three of them jumped down from the carriage and started out in pursuit of the running women. They paid very little attention to our vessels. We were too far offshore to offer them any obvious threat. It is strange how landsmen understand so little about ships and what they are capable of. All their attention was fixed on the women they were pursuing. I knew from bitter experience that, when they had finished with the mother, they would use her infant every bit as brutally. "Are you going in to rescue those women?" Toran cupped his hands around his mouth to shout up at me from the quarterdeck. "There is no place to land safely. Better to let those Hyksos swine live now
if we can slaughter them and 200 of their brethren later," I called down to him, and then gave the order to the helm to lay the ship on an offshore course. Torren remained at the ship's stern rail, staring back at the beach, watching how the charioteers treated the women they had captured. I ignored his outraged shouts of horror and fury. I did not even glance back at what was taking place on the beach. I had seen it all 100 or more times before, but that in no way made it any easier to watch. Instead, I concentrated all my attention on taking my little flotilla well clear of the land and then heading back parallel to the shore, the same way we had come. A few hours previously, we had sailed past a small bay guarded by rocky headlands. This had been gouged out of the mainland by a sizable river. In this dry season, the river itself had been reduced to a trickle. The coastal road crossed it at a ford guarded by steep and rocky banks on each side. These would offer a serious obstacle to the column of chariots coming up along the road towards the port of Sidon. The Hyksos would be forced to manhandle each individual chariot across the ford. Deprived of their manoeuvrability, they would be vulnerable while this was happening. Earlier in the day, as we sailed past this bay, I had taken note of a narrow beach of yellow sand tucked in behind the northernmost headland. This was protected from the main thrust of the sea by the headland itself. The slope was gradual, and the sands looked to be firm enough to allow our chariots to pass over them and reach the hard ground beyond. I headed back along the coast towards this natural site for an ambuscade. As I passed each of my other galleys, I steered close enough to shout my orders across to the men on board. One after the other, they went about and followed the outrage back to the landing I had chosen. We had all canvas set, and the oarsmen had increased the stroke from cruise speed to attack speed. Cruise is the stroke that men on the oars can maintain for 3 hours without respite, while attack speed will exhaust them completely in an hour. The wakes churned white and curling under our sterns as we raced for the landing ground. We were moving so fast that I doubted the oarsmen could keep up the stroke rate. However, their blood was up, and they never faltered until we saw the bay open up ahead of our bows. I studied it eagerly and realized that it was even better suited to my purpose than I had at first imagined. The beach was wide enough to accommodate 2 of my galleys simultaneously. This would speed up the task of getting my force ashore. In addition to this benefit, I saw now that the road along which the Hyksos chariot column would be forced to approach the ford was lined with thick and almost impenetrable bush and trees. This would severely hamper the development of the rear echelon of their chariots. They would be unable to advance because the ford would be blocked by the leading vehicles being dragged through it. They could not retreat swiftly because the track was too narrow to allow the chariots to maneuver handily. If I concealed my archers in the bushes on each side of the track, they would be able to shoot their arrows from murderously close range into these stranded vehicles. I signalled to Hui to bring his galley up alongside me as we approached the bay. I shouted my orders across the narrow gap between our ships. He understood at once what I was asking for, and as we came behind the protection of the headland, we dropped our sails in unison and used opposing thrust on our banks of oars to spin our ships through a half-circle so that we were stern on to the beach. Our chariots were now facing the stern loading ramp. The horses were in the traces, and the crews were in the cockpits of the chariots, fully armed and armoured. At the last moment, Torren rushed down from the upper deck and demanded to be allowed to ride with me in the leading vehicle. I admired his courage, but he was no warrior. Ashore, he would only be a hindrance. He was my contact with the Supreme Minos, and I dare not risk having him killed in the impending battle. Stay on board and observe the action, so that later you can report it to the Supreme Minos. I dismissed him brusquely. At that moment, the ship's stern came up so hard on the hard, wet sand that Torren was thrown off his feet, and he rolled into the scuppers. This solved my problem, and I left him to fend for himself. "Go, go, go!" I shouted, as the stern ramp dropped open with a crash. I whipped up my team and steered them down the ramp. The horses splashed through the water that reached no higher than their hocks. As soon as they lunged up on the dry sand, my crew and I jumped down from the cockpit and put our combined weight to the frame, helping the horses to drag the chariot up the beach onto hard, dry land. Then we immediately jumped back into the cockpit and headed inland at a canter. Chariot after chariot rolled down the ramp and followed mine in quick succession. Before we reached the coastal road, we came suddenly upon a shabby little village that up to this moment had been hidden from my view by a fold in the ground. It consisted of no more than a dozen squalid hovels. As we galloped between them, the occupants came rushing out. The women and their brats were squealing with terror. There were 10 men with them. All of them were dressed in rags, and they were so filthy that their features were barely recognizable as human. But the men had armed themselves with wooden clubs, and they faced us in a pathetic show of defiance. Without stopping, I bellowed at them in Sumerian, "Take your women and children, and run for a safe place in the forest. An army of rapists and killers is coming up the road from the south. They will be here before noon. Run! Get out of here, quickly as you can!" I knew that they would have a hideout in the forest, not too far away. They would not have survived this long without one. I looked back and saw them already acting on my warning. Carrying the children and a few meagre bundles of their possessions, they had abandoned their huts and were scurrying into the scrub like a pack of terrified wild animals. I paid them no further heed, but headed for the coastal road which I could now see ahead of me. When I reached it, I halted without crossing over. All 70 of my chariots had come ashore safely and were bunched up behind me in close order. I looked out to sea and saw that my flotilla of ships was already half a league down the coast and aiming to round the next headland behind which they would anchor. Of course, their oars were shipped, for they had insufficient men to row them. Every man who was not needed to work the sails had taken up arms and come ashore under Zara's command. They were following my squadron of chariots at the double. I could only guess at how long it would take the Hyksos column to arrive at the ford. But unless they were delayed by the pleasures of pillage and rape, my guess was that it would not be much more than 2 or 3 hours, only just sufficient time to make my dispositions to meet them. While I waited impatiently for Zaras to come up with his foot soldiers, I studied the terrain on both sides of the river carefully. Beyond the ford, the forest was too dense for my chariots. I would send Zaras and his infantry across the river to take advantage of the thick cover there. However, on this side of the river, there was open ground from the beach where we had landed right up to the edge of the forest, 200 yards beyond the road, along which we were now parked. Here I would have space to deploy my chariots to the greatest advantage. Once I had decided on my plan of action, I ordered Hui to take his squadron across the dusty road and conceal them along the verge of the forest, there to await my further orders. Hui was a grand master of chariots. I knew I could place my trust in him. I watched as he ordered his drivers to dismount from their vehicles and walk the horses slowly across the road, so as not to raise a dust cloud to alert the Hyksos to our presence. As soon as each vehicle was safely across, the drivers remounted and then trotted over the springy turf to the edge of the forest. Here they dismounted again and reversed the chariot into the cover of the thick undergrowth. Then they went back into the forest to cut leafy branches, which they dragged forward to build a screen in front of the line of chariots. I walked back with Hui to the edge of the road, and we made certain that the chariots were completely hidden. While all this was taking place, Zaras arrived at the road with his archers. In addition to the powerful recurved bow each of them carried, every man had a hank of spare bowstrings draped around his neck, and 3 leather quivers, packed with arrows, slung over his shoulders, 50 arrows for each man. I gave them all a few minutes to catch their breath while I pointed out to Zaras where I wanted him to position himself on the far side of the ford. Then I sent them away again and watched from the high bank as they waded across the stream 200 yards below the ford. As each of them reached the far bank, they smeared their faces and the backs of their hands with black river mud before they climbed the far bank. Zaras and Akimi, his trusted lieutenant, were the last two men up the slope, making certain that they had left no sign to alert the Hyksos to their presence. Once they reached the level ground above the gorge, Zaras concealed his men in the dense forest that bordered the road, placing them at intervals of 20 paces down each side of the track. They were hidden even from close range by the dense foliage and their masks of black mud. The Hyksos column would have to pass between these double ranks of deadly, skilled archers. When Zaras' men had taken up their ambush positions, I hurried back towards the edge of the forest, where my line of chariots waited in ambush. Once I was satisfied that they were completely hidden, I selected a tall tree which grew close behind where my own chariot stood. Without much difficulty, I climbed to its upper branches. From this vantage point, I had a good view of the road on both sides of the ford. I was pleased that even from this height, I could not make out any trace of Zaras' men on the far side of the river. I was at last satisfied with our preparations to receive the Hyksos raiders, and I looked out to sea, only to find that my flotilla of warships had also completely disappeared behind the rocky promontory to the north of the river mouth. The sea was empty, and the forest around me was still and silent, not disturbed by even the rustle of a wild animal or the call of a bird. I waited on my branch until I judged by the changing height and angle of the sun that another hour had passed as slowly as a cripple without his crutches. Then, at the limit of my field of vision, I picked out a pale smear of dust rising above the forest far beyond where Zaras waited with his archers. This cloud of dust gradually drew closer and became more substantial. Suddenly, at the base of the cloud, I saw a flash of reflected sunlight off a polished metal surface, a helmet or perhaps the blade of a weapon. Shortly after this, I saw the first pair of chariots appear around the distant bend in the road. There was no doubt that they were Hyksos. The high and ungainly design of the carriage and the clumsy wheels with the gleaming knives set into the rims were all distinctive. The Hyksos column entered that section of the road along which Zaras waited with his archers. When the head of the column reached the bank of the ford, the Hyksos officer in the leading chariot raised his gloved fist to signal the squadron coming up behind him to halt. Then the commander very carefully studied the ford below him and the ground on our side of the river. Even from this distance, I could tell that he was a fop. His cloak was dyed a vivid Tyrian blue. 3 or 4 sparkling necklaces hung at his throat. His helmet was of polished bronze, with hinged silver cheek pieces that were cunningly engraved, and I coveted it. Satisfied at last that there was nothing untoward waiting for him, the Hyksos officer jumped down from his vehicle and ran down the rocky track to reach the river at the bottom of it. He did not hesitate, but with 3 of his men following him, he plunged into the water and waded across to the opposite bank. Satisfied that it was fordable, he turned and climbed back to where he had left his chariot. He mounted up, and with shouts of encouragement to his horses, he steered them down the bank. His horses balked at the verge of the river, but he cracked his whip over their heads, and reluctantly they edged forward until the river lapped their bellies. Then suddenly the offside wheel struck a submerged rock, and the chariot was thrown over on its side. The horses in the traces were dragged down onto their knees and pinned there by the weight of the capsized vehicle and the pressure of the running water. The driver and his 2 crewmen were flung overboard and pulled under by the weight of their armour and accoutrement. Immediately, the men in the following vehicles jumped down and waded out to the floundering men and horses. With the hubbub of shouted orders and counter-orders, they pulled the men to the surface before they drowned, and then they lifted the chariot back onto its wheels. Once the horses had regained their footing, they heaved the vehicle out of the water and up the steep bank onto level ground, directly in front of where our own chariots were hidden. Cautiously, The other enemy drivers steered their chariots down the bank into the ford, where the waiting gang shoved and manhandled them across the river. From my perch, I had a fine view of the column of enemy chariots backed up behind the ford, waiting their turn to make the crossing. I was able to keep an accurate count of their total number, and I put this at no more than 160, as opposed to the 200 chariots that Artan had warned me to expect. I knew that the shortfall could be explained by the losses that the Hyksos must have suffered on the long, hard drive that they had made up from northern Egypt over the past 16 days. The design of their vehicles rendered them susceptible to broken axles and shattered wheel rims. There was also the attrition of their horses caused by the long hours of hard driving over torturous terrain and rough roads. As each chariot made the crossing of the ford and came up the bank to park on the level on his side of the river, the crews hobbled the horses and then turned them loose to graze. Then the men either threw themselves down on the grass to rest and sleep, or they gathered around hastily lit cooking fires to prepare themselves a hot meal. I was surprised but pleased that their commander allowed such sloppy behaviour and relaxed discipline to prevail while they were in an unknown and potentially hostile territory. He posted no sentries or lookouts, and sent no scouts to reconnoitre the road ahead. He even allowed his men to set aside their heavy armour and weapons while they relaxed. Most of them seemed close to exhaustion, and none of them approached the perimeter of the forest in which our chariots were hidden. Even those of them who were forced to answer the call of nature did not wander off too far from their comrades to do their business. Here in this strange and foreign land, the Hyksos troops instinctively kept close together for mutual protection. On the far side of the river, the congestion of men, chariots, and horses on the road through the forest was gradually relieved. I was counting the chariots as they arrived on this bank. I was anticipating the moment when the enemy had been split into two equal groups, and all of them had been completely lulled into the absence of any apparent threat. As the moment drew closer, I took the bright yellow silk scarf from my pocket, where I had concealed it, and I unrolled it. The Hyksos commander in the blue cloak and conspicuous helmet was still standing on the bank above the ford, supervising the crossing of his troops. However, I could still see nothing of Zaras or any of his men, although I knew precisely where every one of them was hidden. When he had seen me climb into the tree, Zaras had given me a cheery wave before settling down in his own hide. The next Hyksos chariot climbed the track out of the river gorge. With the horses lunging against the traces, and the men behind it heaving and straining. This was number 85 of those who had so far made the river crossing. The Hyksos force was now in the critical position of being divided into two almost equal halves, neither of which was in a position to offer support to the other. In my tome on the art of war, I have written, "An enemy riven is an enemy driven." This was an opportunity to demonstrate the wisdom of my own teachings. I stood up slowly, balancing easily on the branch of my tree. I waved the bright yellow scarf 3 times around my head. Across the river I saw Zaras come to his feet immediately. He raised his clenched fist in my direction, acknowledging my signal. In his other hand he held his war bow, with an arrow nocked and ready. I waited just long enough to watch the thick undergrowth on both sides of the road come alive with Zaras' men as they rose from cover. As one man, they lifted their bows, poised for the order to release their first volley. Zaras was first to let his arrow fly. It rose high against the backdrop of the distant blue mountains. I knew which target he had chosen even before his arrow began to drop. The Hyksos commander was still standing on the bank with his back turned to Zaras. He was thrown forward by the heavy strike of the arrow, and he tumbled down the steep bank out of my line of sight. Zaras already had 3 more arrows in flight. He is very quick, every bit as fast as I am. His men followed his lead, and their missiles rose like a quick dark cloud of locusts, and then dropped upon the line of stranded Hyksos chariots strung out along the road between the two companies of bowmen. In the heat, most of the Hyksos charioteers had removed their helmets and body armour. Their horses were protected only by the thick felt battle blankets that cover their backs, but left their withers and rumps exposed. I could clearly hear the soft whoomp, whoomp sound of flint arrowheads striking living flesh and driving deep. This was followed immediately by the cries of wounded men and the shrill whinnying of their horses as they also were struck. Pandemonium raged through the closely crowded ranks of our enemies. Panicking horses reared in their traces and hacked at the men who were trying to lead them with their forehooves. Those animals that were struck in the hindquarters lashed out in pain with their back legs, smashing the bows of the vehicle they were towing and throwing the occupants overboard. As soon as the drivers lost control of their pain-maddened horses, they tried to bolt, but there was no space in which they could maneuver. They merely crashed into the chariot, which blocked the road ahead of them, and shunted that vehicle into the one ahead of it. Swiftly, it developed into a chain reaction that overturned some chariots, tore the wheels off others, maimed horses and drivers, and eventually caught those chariots in the front ranks and hurled them down the steep gorge into the river. Horses, chariots, and men slid and rolled down the incline on top of the men and chariots that were already waist-deep in the ford, struggling to get across to the far bank. This mass of maddened animals and men, together with the wreckage of their chariots, effectively blocked the ford. There was no escape in that direction. Each of Zaras' archers carried 50 arrows, and at that close range, very few of them missed. I saw one man thrown headlong from the footplate of his chariot, who managed miraculously to keep on his feet without being trampled or shredded by the wheel knives. He started to run to get clear of the turmoil, but then he stopped abruptly after only a few strides as three arrows pegged simultaneously into his naked back. The razor-sharp flint heads protruded abruptly from his hairy chest. Elegantly as a dancer, he spun in a pirouette before he collapsed and was sucked from my view into this maelstrom of death. On my side of the river, the Hyksos charioteers who had already managed to cross the ford jumped up from where they were lying in the grass or sitting beside their cooking fires. They stared back in helpless horror at the slaughter of their comrades on the far bank. I watched no longer, but slid down the trunk of my tree and darted to my chariot. One of my team leaned down and grabbed my arm to swing me up into the cockpit. As I gathered up the reins, I gave the order, "Cohort will advance! Walk! Trot! Charge!" My cry was taken up along the line. In extended line abreast, my chariots burst out of the forest at full gallop. We and I were in the centre, running wheel to wheel. On both sides of us, the squadrons were angled back in arrowhead formation. Ahead of us, most of the Hyksos who had been scattered over the open ground had run back to the bank of the river. Now they crowded there, staring down in helpless horror at the fate that had overtaken their comrades in the ford below them, and on the crowded forest road, which was still being flailed by Zaras' arrow storm. None of the Hyksos chariots on this bank of the river were manned. There were no horses in the traces to draw them. The knee-haltered animals that had been turned loose were scattered across the open grassland. Many of the enemy drivers turned back from the river and raced after their animals in a futile attempt to recapture them. The horses were startled by the sudden uproar and confusion, and they ran wild. Even their leg hobbles could only slow them to the speed of a running man. I threw my head back and shouted with laughter to relieve my fear and express my jubilation. Even above the rumble of the wheels and the thunder of hooves on the hard ground, I heard we echo my laughter. We came down upon them in a solid phalanx, running wheel to wheel with no spaces between us through which any of the Hyksos might escape. Yet still they seemed oblivious to our charge. Most of them were not even looking in our direction. Only those who had given up the race to catch their own teams now stood mesmerized with terror and stared back at us dumbly. They knew that they could not outrun our charge. Our bows were raised, and our arrows were nocked. When we were less than 70 paces from the nearest of them, I shouted the order to let our arrows fly. Even from a racing chariot, most of my lads could hit a running man from 50 paces. Most of the fugitives went down before they could reach their vehicle. I saw only one of them who was able to make it back to where he had parked his chariot. He seized his bow from the weapons bin and a handful of arrows from the quiver. Then he turned back to face us. He was a huge, hairy beast of a man, strong and maddened with rage, like a wild boar standing at bay before the hounds. He raised his bow and got a single arrow away before our arrows began to strike him. His shaft struck the driver of the chariot 3 down the line from mine. He was one of Lord Kratar's sons. He was a fine lad, brave as his father, and 50 times more beautiful. He was one of my favourites, and the arrow killed him. Instantly. I shot 3 arrows into the Hyksos brute before he could knock another of his own. Then every second archer in our line was shooting at him, until he bristled with our arrows like a porcupine with quills. But he stayed on his feet and shot one back at me. It struck high on the forehead of my helmet and glanced away, humming. But the shock almost threw me out of the vehicle. I never suggested that the Hyksos are cowards. In the end, it took 17 arrows to kill this one. 5 of them were mine. I counted them later. After that, it was butchery. I am not averse to a little butchery when the opportunity presents itself, especially in circumstances such as these. However, slave-taking is considerably more lucrative than butchery, so I was the first to call to the fleeing Hyksos in their own language, "Yield, you whining dogs, of Gorab, or die!" "Yield or die!" the call was taken up along our line of charging chariots. "Yield or die!" Most of the fleeing Hyksos dropped to their knees at my first command, and lifted up their empty hands in surrender, but a few of them kept running until my chariot line opened and spread out to encircle them. Then they came up short and panting with exertion and terror. They looked around at the drawn bows, which were aimed at them from every direction, and then their terror turned to resignation, and one after another they fell to earth with cries of "Mercy, in the name of all the gods, spare us, great Lord Taita, we meant you no harm." The good god Horus will attest that I am by no means a glory seeker. However, I am honest enough to admit that I was pleased and flattered to be recognized on the battlefield by my own enemies. "Put the ropes on these little heroes," I ordered Hui. "Sweep the field and bring in all their horses. Allow none of them to escape." I put my own horses into a tight half circle and drove them back to the lip of the gorge above the river crossing. I reined in on the crest and looked down on the carnage that choked the ford and the road beyond it. Here also the fighting was over, and Zarath's men were taking in their prisoners and gathering the loot. I could see at a quick glance that their casualties had been similar to ours on this side of the river. Only light to minimal. I was pleased that Zarath was unhurt, and was supervising the work of taking in the prisoners and rounding up the Hyksos horses. These animals were every bit as valuable as the men. Zarath looked up suddenly and saw me standing on the top of the bank above him. He saluted me and then cupped his hands around his mouth and shouted across the gorge, "More power to your sword, Lord Taita! Another good day's hunting, indeed! I shall soon be able to afford a wife!" It was a silly little joke. I had already made Zarath a wealthy man with his share of the bounty we had captured at the Tamiat fort, and his quip about taking a wife was not very subtle. Nevertheless, I raised a smile and gave him a wave before I turned away. I sent a horseman out to the headland, behind which the flotilla was hidden, with orders to fly the blue recall flag. By now my jubilation was swiftly evaporating, for the worst part of the day lay ahead of me. I had to deal with the Hyksos horses, many of which were injured. I have always had a deep affection for these animals. I was the first man in Egypt to break and tame one of these marvellous beasts, which only made my duty towards them now more onerous. Riding 10 of the unwounded horses bareback, my grooms and I rounded up those surviving horses which were still able to stand. Swiftly, I separated out those animals that were unhurt or only lightly wounded, and these I sent northwards along the coastal road back to Sidon, with my grooms to herd them along. These were trained chariot animals, and therefore particularly valuable. Those animals which had been grievously or fatally wounded, I had dispatched at once to put an end to their suffering. First, I placed a peace offering of crushed millet before each of them, and when they lowered their heads and took a good mouthful, one of my men swung a heavy bronze-headed club down between their ears to shatter the pole of their skull. Their deaths were mercifully swift. Once this ghastly work was done, I turned my attention to our Hyksos prisoners. My order of precedence was clear-cut. As much as I loved the horses, I hated their owners with a deep and bitter loathing. I moved quickly among the ranks of kneeling men, examining each of them in a cursory manner. If they were unwounded, or were only lightly injured, I sent them down to the beach to await the return of my galleys. However, there were many prisoners who were too badly injured to be of further use to us, even as slaves. A man with a barbed arrowhead buried deeply in his chest cavity does not have much time left to wield an oar. I ordered these miserable creatures to be laid out in the shade, given a drink of water to keep them alive a little longer, and left them to work out their own destinies with their vile god, who I was certain was hovering close by. I know that I should have alleviated their suffering as I had their wounded horses with a blow of the club to their heads. But they were Hyksos, and I owed them no special favours. At last I had a moment to think about myself and my two royal charges. I remounted my chariot and drove back to the river crossing and parked on the high bank. I left the reins in the hands of my driver, and I walked to the lip of the gorge. This section of the battlefield was now devoid of a living soul. Although I knew where to search for the body of the enemy commander, I could not pick him out immediately in the litter of wrecked chariots, strewn equipment, and corpses on the opposite bank. Then I spotted a distinctive speck of indigo blue, much further down the slope than I had expected to find him, almost at the river's edge. I started down the steep slope, keeping my balance even with loose stones rolling under my feet. When I reached the bottom, I jumped down into the water and waded across to the far bank. I found the Hyksos captain's corpse deeply wedged between two large rocks. He had rolled down the slope almost to the water's edge. Only a fold of his cloak had revealed his resting place to me. I reached down and grabbed one of his legs by the ankle and heaved him out of the crack in which his body had jammed. There was a copious splash of blood on the cloak, but my servant was an excellent launderer. I folded the cloak and set it aside. Then I searched for the dead man's helmet. I had to work back up the slope to where he had first struck the rocks. There I found it, also providentially hidden under the wreckage of a chariot. The looters, who had been here before me, had overlooked both the helmet and the corpse. I sat down with the helmet on my lap and admired the engravings. These were marvellously rendered images of the Egyptian gods, Hathor and Osiris on the cheek pieces, and Horus on the forehead. The Hyksos captain must have taken it from the corpse of one of our high-ranking officers on another battlefield. It was a treasure almost beyond price. It made my own headdress look shabby and common. It had been badly dented where the Hyksos arrow had struck. I discarded it without a pang. Then, almost reverentially, I replaced it with the gold and silver masterpiece. The interior was padded with leather, and it fitted me as though it had been crafted especially for me. At that moment, I would have given a great deal for a mirror. I scrambled back down to where I'd left the captain's corpse. It was adorned with three necklaces. Like the helmet, they were all three lovely creations. But one of them was decorated with a rock crystal carving of the head of Seth. I hurled it into the river. The other two were marvellously carved ivory depictions of elephants and camels. The princesses would adore them, although they had never seen an elephant in their young lives. I climbed back to where I had left my chariot, and my driver ogled my helmet, struck dumb with awe. I drove back to the beach, where most of the men paused in what they were doing to stare at me. I must have been a wondrous sight.